This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, coming your way from Radio City in Fresno today on News Talk 580 KMJ or online at kmjnow.com. Each week we visit with World War II veterans. The idea is to honor their service, the sacrifice that they made for our country, for the freedom that we enjoy today, to preserve those stories so their families and the rest of us remember what that incredible time in our world's history was like and some of the things that these people went through. And then also, hopefully, to inspire the rest of us, because these are some pretty extraordinary things that at that point young men and women were doing all over the globe. And hopefully the rest of us, as we listen to these stories, will be moved and motivated to make the most of our lives today. Today we're going to speak with an author. Now, he's been described as a lot of things in his life, but I'm going to start off by describing Don Ball as an author, because he has the new book, the autobiographical Follow the Bouncing Ball. His name is Don Ball, so he's the bouncing ball. He was born in Pennsylvania to parents of modest means during the Roaring Twenties. His parents lost everything during the Great Depression in the 30s, through no fault of their own, of course, as did thousands of others. He didn't suffer much living through those times because he says he didn't know any better. You'll find much humor served up within Don's book, Follow the Bouncing Ball, along with a little pathos, some gripping excitement, and much nostalgia of the Depression and the big band era as well. The author served with distinction in the U.S. Army Air Corps during World War II in the 1940s. In fact, he has the Distinguished Flying Cross to prove it, and I'm going to bug him about that by the time we're done. And in his book, he comments with candor on the signs of the times from the 30s through the turn of the century. His graphic account of nearly ditching in the North Atlantic will surely grip you, and I'm going to ask him about that in this program. His comments on World War II and his participation therein are of special interest to World War II buffs, like a lot of you listening to this program, while his observations of life in Great Britain during the war will bring back memories to those who served in the United Kingdom at that time. His brief brushes with many famous people of his day are related here, as they may be of some interest to others. And while the style of some of his anecdotes may remind some of the writings of O. Henry, they were all true and are hereby reported as such. So it's all true, huh, Don?
That's right. It's all true.
Don lives now in Cathy's Valley. A lot of you know where that is, and there's a football player from there who's now playing for the New England Patriots, Logan Mankins. And I know that he's the big man in Cathy's Valley these days, but if you read Don Ball's book, you might change your mind about that, because there's some pretty impressive stories that are contained within. And Don, later on, I'll ask you how folks at home can get copies of that book. But I've heard some of these stories. You and I had a chance to visit a few years ago on television, something that I really enjoyed. And let's start early on. How did you end up in the service? And maybe take us back to that day that I asked so many veterans about, December 7th, 1941. Where were you and how'd you hear about what happened at Pearl Harbor?
Well, if you remember, well, you wouldn't remember, of course. You have to read about it. But I remember it was a Sunday, and I had gotten home from church, and I was standing in front of the house talking to my family, and my sister came running out of the house. She says, "I just heard on the radio that we're in a war." And I said, "What are you talking about?" And she says, "Well, they came on the radio and they said that the Japanese bombed us at Pearl Harbor in Hawaii. And so now we're going to be in a war." Well, for heaven's sakes, I said, I got to hear this. So I ran in the house and turned the radio up so I could hear it good, and sat there and listened. And there was nothing but news of the Pearl Harbor strike that morning. And about all of the brave soldiers and sailors and Marines that lost their lives in that horrific strike. And I remember saying, "Well, boy, I got to do something about this. I'm going to have to probably go into service." But I didn't go. I went to a couple of recruiting stations. What I wanted to do was fly. I wanted to be a pilot. So I went to the Air Force recruiters, and they gave me a physical, and they said that my depth perception wasn't good enough. So they turned me down. So I waited, and I waited, and I thought, well, maybe the Navy would take me. So I got on a train, took the train to Cleveland, Ohio, which was about 125 miles from where I live.
You were in Pennsylvania,
I was in Pennsylvania. And went to Cleveland and tried to enlist in the Navy. They gave me a physical, and they said, well, I'm sorry, but you have an overbite. And
you're learning quite a bit about yourself through this process, huh?
I was, so they turned me down. So I thought, well, I'll just wait till I'm drafted then, I guess. So I waited, and sure enough, I was drafted, and I went in the service on January 15th in 1943. And
I imagine about that time of year in Pennsylvania, it was probably snowing.
Oh, it was, and there was snow drifts along the streets and all. And we got on a train. We went down to New Cumberland, Pennsylvania, where they had a reception, a reception center, they called it, where they processed you in and gave you uniforms. And then from there, we got on a troop train and headed south. And we kept going south, and they kept taking more people off the train as we went through cities and areas where they had a fort or a military installation of some kind.
And I'm guessing you didn't know where you were headed, right?
I was headed. They wouldn't tell us. And so I rode for 3 days on that train. I wound up in Miami, Florida, and they sent us over to Miami Beach. And they put us up in a hotel on Miami Beach. And we took our basic training in Miami Beach, on the beach, a lot of it. And we marched the streets of Miami Beach, counting cadence and all that. And we would meet in the parks, in the open parks we would have lectures in the park on chemical warfare, aircraft recognition, or some such subject pertaining to the war. And I was there for I was supposed to be there for 6 weeks, but I think I was only there 5 weeks because I volunteered. A chance came up to volunteer to be on an airplane crew, and so I volunteered.
So no one had told you to never volunteer in the Army Air Corps, huh?
No, they didn't. Up until then.
Now, I understand. I think when I talked to you about this before, and you described this situation, they told you we need aerial gunners, but they also told you the life expectancy of an aerial gunner. And I still can't understand how, hearing that, you still decided to volunteer for that kind of job. Tell us what that was all about.
Well, yeah, they said the officer on the stage of the theater addressing us said, the life expectancy of an aerial gunner is about 17 minutes. And we thought, holy smokes, you know, that's not much. But what he meant was it was 17 minutes of actual combat. And it was up until then, because it took, when we first started in the war in 1942, they opened bases in England, and they had aircraft over there. And it was about a 17-minute time for the gunners and the B-17s in those days.
Because the Germans had so much opposition in the air.
The Germans had the air superiority.
Mm-hmm.
But by the time I got over there, we were starting to gain air superiority.
You volunteer, and you're still in Miami, but they say, hey, we don't want to give you any time to change your mind. You're heading out tomorrow, right?
Right. So they shipped us out. I didn't even finish basic training. They shipped me out to Aerial Gunnery School in Nevada, Las Vegas, Nevada.
Which I guess probably looked a little different in 1943 than it does now.
Oh, yes. It didn't have all the big hotels and didn't have all the population that it has now. Back in those days, there were only two casinos, which were small. One was the El Rancho Vegas, and what was the name of the other one? I can't remember right off the bat. But they had floor shows, and they would send their show over to the airbase on Sunday afternoons to perform for the military. And so I saw Eddie Cantor on one of those shows. He was a famous comedian back in the old days. And many of the old-timers. But the shows were free, and they were trying to do their bit, I guess, for the GIs.
And so far, I mean, this sounds like a pretty good adventure for you. You got to go from snowy Pennsylvania to Miami,
oh, yeah,
and then to Las Vegas where you're seeing some shows. But then they finally said, "Up, you're headed to South Dakota." How much fun was that?
Yeah, it was in, I think, April, and there was still patches of snow on the ground when we got there. And they were having a tough winter, and they had a lot of flu and illnesses at the base. And when I got there, the snow was melting, and there was patches of snow some places, but there was a lot of dust, and there was a lot of wind. And the wind would blow that dust to the point where us guys, we had been issued gas masks. So we put the gas masks on to even go to the chow hall to eat. And you take them off, and you'd have a white face, and the rest of your face was all black from dust.
Maybe that was their way of getting you to want to go overseas. If being back home in South Dakota was that tough, maybe you wanted to get out of there. But that was where you learned how to send and receive code, to be a radio man on a bomber crew. Before that, in Vegas, you learned how to be a gunner in the air and probably shot a lot of sleeves with painted bullets to try to practice your aim and everything. But I imagine at this point, you got a sense that this was all leading somewhere, that you were going to be assigned to a bomber crew and that you were going to spend some time in the air. Was that something that you found yourself looking forward to? The more time that went by, you kind of were hoping you'd get put on a crew pretty quickly?
We were antsy. We wanted to go, and we wanted to be assigned to a crew, because, and after all, when we joined, we were getting $21 a day once a month. That was the pay for the Army in those days, and the only way you could get more would be to advance in rank. Well, they had a what they call a table of organization, and to be on a plane crew, the lowest rank was a staff sergeant, and the upper turret gunner, engineer, they called him also, and the radio operator gunner, we were assigned as a tech sergeant. Technical sergeant, so we got five stripes. It took about 3 months to get them, because they had to advance your rank each month, one rank. And by the time we went in, I mean, by the time we left Aerial Gunnery School, we were private first class. And then when we came out of radio school, I was a buck sergeant, three stripes.
And that felt good. I need to cut you off there, Donks. We need to catch our first commercial break. But when we come back, we're going to hear about Don Ball's adventures in the air. This is Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes with you on News Talk 580 KMJ. I'm your host, Paul Leffler, and we are following the bouncing ball. Follow the Bouncing Ball is the title of Don Ball's new book. He's our guest today. And he was following another ball for a while, a baseball that was being pounded with the bat held by his son, Jeff Ball. If you're a Fresno Grizzly fan, you certainly remember the first season of AAA baseball in the Valley. And Jeff Ball was the star of that Fresno Grizzlies team. We all got so excited for him when he got to go up to the big leagues and play for the Giants briefly. He, of course, had a great career at Atwater High and Merced College and with those San Jose State Spartans as well. And Jeff is still involved in the game back east, but his dad, Don, is our guest today. I don't know if we'll spend that much time talking about baseball, Don, but when we left off, we were talking about your time on a B-17 crew. In fact, you told us you were antsy to actually get on a crew and go do something, and especially with the pay raise that would accompany that. But before long, you finally did get that chance. Do you remember what it was like the first time you got up in a B-17 and realized, okay, this is what I'm going to be doing?
Yeah, well, of course, we were assigned. I was a charter member of the 398 Bomb Group, and they assembled that at the Salt Lake City Army Air Base. They sent all the graduates from the radio school, gunnery school, and also the armor school, and also the officers and the pilots, co-pilots, navigators, and bombardiers. They sent them all there to make up crews to be assigned to the 398 Bomb Group, which was being formed there. This was in 1944. They started assigning us in December at Salt Lake, December of 43.
So you end up in the 398th Bomb Group, the 602nd Bomb Squadron. You're a radio man and gunner on a B-17 with a little window on the world. And I'm sure it was always going through your head, what am I going to see once I finally get over there? But before you had a chance to go overseas, and I love this about your story. I don't think I've heard anyone that can match this one or have this particular twist to a story. Before you went overseas, you actually got to fly over your hometown. And I don't know what the chances of that are, but you had to go from Kansas to Maine, and on the way, that path took you right over your hometown of Northeast Pennsylvania?
That's right.
I mean, I imagine you're probably the only guy on that plane that was flying over his hometown.
Yeah, I was. And so we talked about it the night before in Kansas. Actually, I think it was Nebraska. But anyway, we talked about it. We said, we got to do something special for this. So somebody said, well, I got a... I said, let's drop something down there, and they'll find it. I'll put my mother's name and address on it. They'll find it and take it to her. So they said, okay, let's do that. So
now, I'm sure you didn't ask anybody's permission for that, right?
Oh, no. We just decided to do it. So I took an old flight. I had an extra flight jacket and flying coveralls and a few odds and ends from my duffel bag we put in there. And I took a pen and wrote my mother's name and address on the outside of this bag. It was a big bag. It was about, the thing was probably over 6 feet long, and we tied the end of it with some heavy twine. And
now, this is a pretty small town in Pennsylvania we're talking about, right?
Decided to, I told him, now, when we go over our town, you let me know, and one of the waste gunners will be by the back door, and I'll look out there, and I'll point out the house to you, and then I'll tell, on the intercom, I'll tell the waste gunner, okay, salvo, and we'll drop it. So we did that.
Now, I got to ask you, Don, did it ever occur to you that the people of Northeast Pennsylvania might be alarmed to see a B-17 flying over and dropping a very large object toward the city?
I didn't think they'd be alarmed, but as it turned out, they were.
I wonder why.
Yeah, and to see a white cloth come out of the side of the thing like a parachute and not open and just continue down. Well, it fell into a grape vineyard behind our house, and the grape vineyard belonged to the town barber, and so he checked it over. He didn't look inside it. He just took it to my mother, and so they had an article in the weekly newspaper the next week, which I cut out, and I still have it today. Local man drops package on his way overseas or something like that. Anyway, it made quite a... The pilot says, what we'll do, he says, we'll kind of buzz the town. So he did. He buzzed the town. And this huge airplane with four engines made quite a racket. And then he pulled up when we dropped this thing out and continued on our way. And in the article it says, Mrs. Ball said... she thought her husband was on his way, or her son was on his way overseas. Well, she was right.
Yeah, and when you shared that with the crew, I imagine they said, uh-oh, there's documentation now of the stunt we pulled. I hope we don't get in trouble for it.
Yeah, the pilot says, I hope nobody got our number off the tail.
And as far as you know, nobody did, right?
Well, I guess not. We never heard any more about it.
Now, I read at the start of this program a little bit of a blurb about your book, just a taste of some of the things that are contained in Follow the Bouncing Ball. And before we're done, you're going to tell us how people listening at home can get a copy of that, maybe even have you sign it. But one of the things that's mentioned there is having to nearly ditch in the North Atlantic. And I believe that probably wasn't too long after you flew over your hometown that you started to head overseas.
About 2 days, yeah. We were on our way to Bangor, Maine, when we flew over my house. But after we flew over my house, we had a problem with a alternator on the plane. And so we stopped in Grenier, New Hampshire, Grenier Field, and they changed out the alternator. And then we continued on the next day to Goose Bay, Labrador. And it was from Goose Bay, Labrador, that we were to go to Iceland, which was a fairly long journey across the North Atlantic. And so we left Goose Bay with its piles of snow along the runways and all, and started out over the North Atlantic. Well, we got out about 2 hours, and one of the engines, we had a problem with it, and it we had to feather the prop. Now, by that, we mean you have to lock it in place so that the wind doesn't make it turn, and it would vibrate off the plane. So you turn it in the vertical position and then lock it. So we did that, and then we kept on flying. And about a half an hour later, we had a problem with another engine. Apparently, the extra load of the flying made another engine conk out, and it had, what happened with that one was that they had a turbo amplifier, and which boosted the power, and it blew out. Now it was mainly a lot of electronics in it, and they had a spare amplifier on the plane. And I remember them telling me, hey, you know, you have that spare amplifier underneath the radio table in your radio room. Don't kick it with your feet and damage it or anything. So I said, all right. So anyway, that was a natural place for it. The amplifiers were mounted in the radio room in a row, four of them, one for each engine. But the spare was underneath the radio table. Well, when that blew, it was up to the engineer to find out what was wrong with the engine. And he says, hey, he says, he called me on the intercom, and he says, Don, he says, I think there's a spare turbo amplifier on the plane. Do you know where it is? And I was, by that time, I was sending out an SOS. I was busy with a lot of things. And I said, gee, I know that we have one, but I can't remember where it is. And so that was that. And I kept on sending. I sent out an SOS. It was picked up by a station on Baffin Island. And
so just to clarify here, you're sending out an SOS. In other words, you aren't that sure that you guys are going to make it to Iceland, and you might be swimming in the frigid North Atlantic, and that's why you're sending out the SOS, right?
We're losing altitude. We've feathered two props.
So you're down to two engines on a four-engine plane.
We're down to two engines on a four-engine plane. We had a big, heavy box in the bomb bay full of the mechanics' tools. Plus, we had there were 11 men on the plane. We carried an extra man with us to take him overseas, the operations officer, and all the bags for everybody. They were all in the bomb bay. So we started losing altitude, of course, with only two engines. And so we're going down eventually if we don't do something. So pilot says, well, we got a salvo. It's whatever's in the bomb bay. We got to get rid of it. So he did. We opened the bomb bay doors, and they pulled the chain, and down it went.
So somewhere in the North Atlantic, some whales got a pretty big surprise falling from a B-17 out of the sky. And, Don, I'll tell you what, we're going to leave you in the air over the North Atlantic for a moment as we catch another commercial break. When we come back, well, you know he's talking to me, so you know that he made it okay. But how did that happen, and how harrowing did it get? We're going to find out when we come back, and also hear how Don Ball, our guest today, ended up earning the Distinguished Flying Cross. I think you'll appreciate that one as well. We'll be right back with the rest of Hometown Heroes. It's News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
We continue on with Hometown Heroes. When we left off, our guest Don Ball, author of the new book Follow the Bouncing Ball, was suspended over the North Atlantic, and maybe not suspended for long. The B-17, on which he served as a radio man and gunner, was quickly losing altitude. The crew had thrown out all of the luggage on board, even a box full of tools for the mechanic. It was splashing into the North Atlantic, and they thought they would soon suffer a similar fate. The SOS calls had gone out. Don was responsible for sending that out. It had been picked up by another station. They didn't expect that they were going to touch down on land, but that wasn't the end of the story. Don, pick it up where we left off. After you jettisoned all that material, did it help? Did the plane gain any altitude back?
Yes, we were able to stabilize that, and we were able to maintain our altitude. And the Baffin Island radio station says, Don, tune up your liaison transmitter on voice, and then the pilot can talk to us just using his throat mic. He can talk to us, and we'll give him directions. And I said, okay. So I took time out and tuned up my SCR 287 transmitter on a voice instead of the radio signals, and he talked to them in clear text, and they decided that we should, rather than fly on to Iceland with two engines, we might not make it, might run out of gas, so we were to go to Greenland, which was probably about 4 hours north. And so we're kind of on pins and needles all this time, but we flew.
And how low would you say you got? I mean, we're at the point where you can see some icebergs waiting for you down there, or what?
Well, I thought we did. I'm not sure that we did, but there were white specks down there that I thought probably were icebergs. I think we were probably at about 1,800 to 2,200 uh-huh. feet, and I'm not sure. But
now, what about this turbo amplifier? Did it ever turn up? Because it seems to me like that could have saved the day for you.
the engineer came back to the radio room. He says, "Don," he says, "you're supposed to know where that thing is." I said, "Oh," I said, "is this it down here under the radio table?" "Oh, thank God," he says, "that's it." And so there was a four clips that held it in place, and he took it off, and he removed the one for the engine that had conked out and replaced that. And so that's how the pilot was able to restart the engine. So that saved the day for us, and we were able to continue on into Greenland, which was it was still quite a stretch up there. And the runway was, there was only one runway, and it was uphill, had a 5% upgrade. And you landed uphill, and you took off downhill, no matter which way the wind blew. So that was an experience. For the pilots.
I'm sure you guys had trained on a runway like that.
Oh, no. We had plenty of room any place we ever landed before. But this, we had an undercast. We flew into the radio range station in Greenland, which was on the tip of Greenland. And when we got there, we just followed radio signal, of course. And then contacted the base, and the base says, "Well, just stay up there. There was an undercast." They said, don't come down through the undercast. "We'll send a plane up to guide you in." And we thought this was kind of strange, but they did. They sent what they called a Norseman small plane up, and we followed them back out to sea, and then we lowered down through the undercast. And then we made a circle around and came back to a fjord. Like, it was like a tunnel. I mean, there was clouds over the top and cliffs, steep cliffs on each side, with this river like coming down to the sea. And we flew up this river, and there was turns and so on that you had to make. And we had a big plane, and that little plane, of course, was ahead of us and showed us where to go. And there was a lot of places that he showed us where to turn, that had we been alone, we might not have made the same choice and hit the side of the cliff, you know. So it was kind of scary. But anyway, we landed uphill, and we stayed there for, I think it was 5 days, while they changed the engine. They had to fly an engine in because they didn't stock anything like that at that little base. That base was like a weather station.
Wow.
And the people that were there for two or three years at a time. And then out of the group that was there, they would send weather observers out in the fall, and they would give them a year's supply of food and pick them up in 6 months so they could eat. They were sure to have plenty to eat if there was something to keep
This kind of sounds like the International Space Station these days or something, and I guess that's a place where you're glad you get to leave pretty quick and you don't start to worry that you're going to be stuck there for a year or two.
That's right.
And before long, you did make it over to Europe. One of those cases where getting there is as hard as what you do once you're there. But
right.
Since this program's moving along, I want to make sure we haven't gotten to a single mission of yours yet, and I want to make sure that we do that. And I want to save some time for that. So I'll tell you what, we're going to take our final commercial break right here. When we come back, we're going to hear about some of Don Ball's 32 missions flying in a B-17 over German-occupied territory in Europe, including the one that earned him the Distinguished Flying Cross. And the first thing when we get back from this break, I'm going to have Don tell us how you can get his book. I don't want to forget that. Follow the Bouncing Ball is the title. Don Ball of Cathy's Valley, our guest today. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ. Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We're running out of time, so before we do that, I do want to tell you, if you want to get Don Ball's book, you can only get it online at a website called Ex Libris. I'll make it easy for you. I will point you right to Don's page for Follow the Bouncing Ball. You go to our website, kmjnow.com, go to the Paul Leffler page, and you'll have everything you need to know about ordering that book online in either hardcover or softcover edition. But now let's hear a little bit more about what's inside that book. And Don, we haven't talked about your 32 missions in the air over Europe. That included June 6, 1944. Your bomber was one of legions of bombers that were flying air support for the D-Day invasions. And probably the most unforgettable mission you had was, what I understand, it was a bombing run aimed at Hamburg, but you guys hit a little flak when you were coming up over Holland.
That's right. We were coming over the Zuider Zee, which is the big... It's like a big bay going into Holland. And all of a sudden, we received about eight bursts of flak up through our whole formation. Several of the planes were hit. There was a big explosion right underneath us. And we continued on. After the eight bursts were over with, there was no more flak, so we continued on. And we got a call from the gunner in the waist saying, I got a call. Don, you better get back here. I think Grant's been hit. Well, Grant was our replacement man that came in came onto our crew after we had flown, well, before we flew our missions. Anyway, he was our waist gunner, and a piece of flak had come up through the bottom of the airplane and hit him right at the top of his boot, and it severed his leg at that point. It was just hanging by the skin. And so I went back, and he was trying to get up. It knocked him down. He was trying to get up, and so I said, just stay down, lay flat,